And welcome to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are back again. This time, thought I'd spend a little time talking with my friend John Farrell. John writes for Forbes magazine. He has an interest in particular in science and the faith, among other things. He's written a book called The Day Without Yesterday, which is it's a account of Monsignor Georges Lemaître and the Big Bang Theory. That, by the way, is not an indie band. That is. And anyway, we got John Farrell here today. How you doing, John?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
Good.
It's gone from frighteningly cold to like spring warm, and we're going to get several inches of rain, I think, in the next few days. So
holy moly!
Yeah,
you guys just got over flooding, right? I mean he lives in Boston. For listeners who are wondering what I'm talking about.
Yes, sea flooding, but I think now they're worried about flooding caused by large piles of snow covering all the sewers so that the water has nowhere to go. This could be flooding in the city more than what we had before, so okay. Everybody's kind of bracing for that.
Okay. Yeah, we got some flood warnings out here in Seattle just because of boring, dull winter rain. That's all there is to it. It's rainy now. Because that's what it does. We had our once a decade miracle here in Seattle, and we actually had a white Christmas.
This is nice.
Extraordinarily rare. There were 11 white Christmases in the 20th century. So that gives you some idea of what things are like out here.
And so once a decade, basically. Yeah, that's
once a decade. Yeah, we get a white Christmas, and so we had it, and it was like gone. On St. Stephen's Day, it all melted away and disappeared, and now it's just been raining seemingly for all eternity. I feel like I'm in a H.P. Lovecraft. There's an H.P. Lovecraft or Bradbury story that's set on an extraordinarily rainy Venus.
That's Bradbury, yes. In fact, they filmed it. I don't know if you ever saw the adaptation of The Illustrated Man with Rod Steiger and Claire Bloom.
Oh.
And they picked three of the stories, and that was one of them. The astronauts trapped on a very wet, rainy Venus.
Okay.
It was pretty well done.
Yeah. We went – now you're reminding me of a story because we went on – we go on Memorial Day weekend. It is our custom to go to our Hidden Island Redoubt out in – Puget Sound, and so we spend several days out there. And normally, it's pretty dry out there in the San Juans. So Memorial Day weekend is almost always a very pleasant time. But now and then, being Washington, you'll get rain. And this trip to Lopez Island was just nothing but endless soggy rain, and my son had brought his copy of Bradbury, and that's the story he was reading, and he was reaching the point where he was like, I'm going to go mad. It's never going to stop raining. So anyway, well, I hope that you guys don't flood out. I thought it'd be fun to have you on the show today to talk about a couple of things. One, which we'll get to in a little bit, is the impending something Tolkien thing that Netflix is promising to do. We'll talk about that a little later on in the show. I'm not entirely clear what it is Netflix means to do, but I'm willing to be highly skeptical and afraid. But we'll get to that in a little bit. But I thought it might be interesting to start out talking about a kind of an interesting relationship that goes back in the West, which is the relationship between science and magic. Magic is, I would say, a perennial temptation. In the human mind, it's the desire for godlike control
right
over the created world. And you don't have to you know, use a lot of imagination to realize that that same temptation expresses itself in our relationship with science. Because one of the things that C.S. Lewis notes is that the high watermark of interest in the Western world in science was not in the fabled Dark Ages. You know, we have these, you know, we have this sort of image that we get from, you know, Disney and fantasy fiction and all the rest of it, that there was some, there was the Dark Ages,
right,
which were way back when. And sometime after the fall of the Roman Empire, but before the Renaissance. And that's when everybody was interested in magic, because they were all 1,000 years dumber than we are now.
Exactly.
But what Lewis...
It's a conveniently long, it's a conveniently long period during right. which, you know, you could have posited anything of happening, you know. And it's almost like that famous opening to the Conan stories, you know. Way back, you know, before Atlantis, and there were shining kingdoms spread across the world, and you could basically dump in there anything you can imagine because it was conveniently dark.
Right, right. And but what Lewis points out, which I think is fascinating, is that the actual high watermark of interest in magic in the attempt through incantation, words of power, sometimes, you know, the use of material objects, talismans, and so on and so forth. The high watermark of that coincides exactly with the birth of science, primarily in the 16th century is where Lewis places it.
Right.
And Lewis says that's not an accident. Both arise from the same impulse, the desire for godlike control. And science, you know, magic dies out and science doesn't, because science worked and magic doesn't work.
Right.
But the impulse is the same. And I think that that's significant, because I don't think the magical impulse really goes away. What happens is that it's suppressed by the fact that it doesn't work. But when we come to modernity, one of the things that happens is that science has achieved such a spectacular success that people who are simply relying on the scientific work that other people have done for them now have the leisure to try to get back to magic again, because they're lazy. And they still right. hope that magic will work, you know. And so you see this on the internet, for example. You know, you see a society that benefits from a massive amount of medical work that's been done for it by people who have inaugurated, you know, vaccination campaigns and have improved public health immensely, so that we don't have to worry about somebody dunking, you know, pouring a bucket of feces on our head as we're walking down the street, which was a real issue
right.
in medieval Europe, you know, and you're not walking down the street with raw sewage flowing down the gutters and all the rest of it. So we've had all of this and many, many other kinds of gifts of the sciences given to us. And as a result, we have now a leisured class that has the capacity to say, I don't think I need to worry about vaccination, because I'm going to just use essential oils and positive thinking.
Right. Because I read it on the internet or in my Facebook group.
Which is itself another colossal triumph of science. You know, the existence of the internet is a huge triumph of science, and yet we use it now to spread scientific gobbledygook. You know, so we've got my personal favorite thing that you run into on Facebook is you can visit the page of the Flat Earth Society, which, as it boasts, has members around the globe.
Yeah. And that's written with a straight face. Yes.
Yes. And that really, that in itself almost perfectly illustrates the paradox that you have people who, you know, one of the things that the sciences demand of us is that we use our brains somewhat. Yeah, obviously, none of us are going to be, or not, most of us are not going to be particle physicists or going to be able to express, you know, Einstein's equations in physics language and all the rest of it. Most of what we know as lay people comes to us because we watched the Discovery Channel and we trusted right. the people who told us something there. But because of that, it's easy for us to get lazy. And the mark of the lazy person is he wants all the benefits without the hard work. And wants to be able to believe, and this is really the mark of magic, that by his sovereign word of power, he can just make something, he can just create reality by saying things are the way that he says they are.
Yes. Yeah.
And that's really that's the magical impulse, is the desire to have the literally godlike power of the word, because our Christian tradition tells us that God in fact creates by the power of the word, capital W, the logos, God, the second person of the Trinity. And the parody of that is magic, is the attempt to claim that I'm just going to make things be the way I want them to be. And you can see that little kids try this, right? They do something yes. bad, and then they plug their ears, and they close their eyes, and they stamp their feet, and they say, I didn't do it. No, it didn't happen. And they imagine that they can somehow make that be reality just by the power of their word.
Yes, exactly.
The paradox of the sciences is that it has created a leisured class that increasingly believes that. You know, so flat earthers, anti-vaccination people. What are some other examples?
Well, of course, our favorite, the geocentrists. there's also, how would you put this? Well, actually, here's a great article I just came across before we got in touch, which I saw. Canadian National Post. Well, there's some controversy in Canada about doing a television documentary kind of promoting this crackpot, and apparently it's a crackpot theory, that the initial Indians came over not from Asia, but from Europe, something that's been apparently refuted over and over again. And there's some embarrassment, I think, among the Canadian scientists that this kind of very popular, respected, it's not a PBS channel, but something like that, is nevertheless going ahead with this documentary, which has been apparently a big thing with white supremacists, you know, who insist that America was colonized by people from Europe, not from Asia. So there's another kind of example, and I'm sure you could probably go on the web and find these guys. They probably have their own forums, their own blogs, their and all of that.
Oh, sure. Well, it's part of the nature of the internet that it allows these people to first connect and then seal themselves off in a cognitive bubble, where they could just tell each other, you know, the same round of lies and affirm each other, you know, in these crazy theories. You know, one of the things that here's an interesting factoid you may not know. I discovered this because I am working on a kooky novel about nutty things that make fun. I mean, they're loads of fun in a novel. You know, my fear is that if I ever publish the novel, people are going to ask me if I really believe this stuff, which of course I don't. It's a novel, right? But here's
this is the one you. This is the one you started working on recently, right?
Right.
I think
I
saw you posting about that. Yeah.
Yeah. Excellent. Well, here's an interesting true fact. During World War II, the Third Reich spent more money on occult research than the United States spent on the Manhattan Project. Now, you may ask yourself, why would they do that crazy thing, right? Well, of course, because one of the marks, especially of tyrannical regimes, is precisely magical thinking, is the idea that the word of the dear leader creates reality. And so, you know, you see this at the end of the Third Reich with Hitler moving around imaginary armies as he's sitting there in the bunker. You know, there is no correspondence to reality left. But he's built his entire life on lies. Well, when you do that, the doom of the person who builds his life on lies is to be severed from reality. That's what happens. And so one of the things, you know, Himmler was hugely interested in the occult. And so the Nazis series, I'm not making this up, so the Nazis actually mounted expeditions to go search for portals to the hollow earth, because this was the thing that they thought was real, you know. And so they spent millions of Reichsmarks on these things, you know, and they went to Tibet in search of some sort of wonder food or something called Vril that was supposed to, you know, magically enhance the human machine or something like this. And so they went in search of Vril, and they there was one poor sap. He's actually going to wind up, he's the basis of a character in my novel, actually. There was one poor sap who was sort of like the German equivalent of Art Bell. Art Bell, for those of you who are not up to date on Crackpot Radio, Art Bell was this guy. I think he's dead now. But he had this radio show that he broadcast from somewhere near Area 51. And he interviewed, you know, people who claimed to see UFOs and, you know, ultra-dimensional beings and, you know, all this kind of
abducted. Yeah.
Yeah. So all of this stuff. Well, there was this guy in Weimar Germany and then on into Nazi Germany who was like this guy. He was a harmless character himself, just kind of a kook. And he was like totally into the Holy Grail. And he had all these theories about the Holy Grail and how to find the Holy Grail and et cetera, et cetera. Well, unfortunately for this guy, he acquired a number one fan. And that number that number one fan was Heinrich Himmler. And so Himmler comes to this guy and he says, I believe in you and I believe in what you're trying to do. And so he inducted this poor schmuck into the SS. This guy was totally not SS material, but he put him in the SS, and you're not going to argue with Heinrich Himmler, so he made him a member of the SS, and then he just showered him with gazillions of Reichsmarks and said, all right, go to it. I believe in you. Go find the Grail. Well, now it was truly publish or perish. And so this guy set out on his quest for the Grail, and there was only one problem, which is there's no Grail. And so he couldn't find the Grail, and eventually by about 1939, Himmler was tired of throwing a ton of money at this guy and getting no results, and so he said, you know, do the right thing. And so the guy wound up committing suicide. So it's a tragic story, but Himmler didn't learn from this that there's no Grail. Instead, he just, you know, continued the quest, because when you're severed from reality, that's what you do. And this is the essence of magical thinking.
And you putting this in your novel, or is this going to be alluded to?
I've said too much already.
My agent is on the line listening.
Okay. So it's just a kooky adventure yarn that I'm working on. But at any rate, what interests me though is that relationship between the will to power that cuts itself off from reality in the magical quest. So, for example, Stalin, communist though he was, still manifests this magical way of thinking. during his 5-year plans. So he's got, he sets up the 5-year plans and he wants to, you know, renew Soviet agriculture and all the rest of it. Well, one of the things that his 5-year plans called for was particular weather at particular times of the year. And everything depended on, you know, his magical demand that the weather would cooperate with his, you know, dictatorial will. And so he actually had meteorologists in the Soviet Union shot for counter-revolutionary weather forecasting. because, you know, the will of the magician is supposed to be able to create reality by the sheer force of his words. And just because you're an atheist and a communist doesn't mean you're going to be immune. In fact, the likelihood is you're far more prone to that impulse. This is why communism killed so many people, is because they didn't conform to the will of the magician. They actually, you know, had their own lives and behaved the way human beings do, not the way communist ideology said that they were supposed to.
And, right, exactly.
Yeah. And this is something that we're all prone to. And the danger of the sciences, I think, is that it makes it easier for the magical will to be imposed on people. Because with the sciences, you really can apply technology to people to do terrible things to them when they don't fulfill the magical will. So anyway, I thought that was interesting. When you talk to people who, for example, take seriously the idea that 97% of climate scientists are all part of a conspiracy, how do you speak to that?
Well, my last attempt was to actually connect the person to a scientist, which failed. But I think what's fascinating, and to your point, it's like, and you've probably heard this, you know, because we were talking about this before, was it Arthur C. Clarke who said any sufficiently advanced civilization would be indistinguishable from magic? And we're kind of already there. Uh-huh. Where you could do, like, if you went and got in a time machine and went back to, like, maybe only 200 years ago with your iPhone, and assuming, you know, you were still in touch with all of the networks that exist today, you would scare the daylights out of people because they would think that you were telepathically communicating with, you know, invisible spirits, when in fact you were just texting your mom or me or someone else to say, I'll be back in 2 hours, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But yet even something as simple as an iPhone, as we've learned, can be used for almost like demonic purposes, driving other kids at school to commit suicide,
right?
You know, by bullying and stuff, is, you know, stuff that 500 years ago you would have attributed to demons in somebody's head, or, you know, so-and-so's daughter jumped in the river and killed herself because, well, she was possessed. And so now 500 years later, you know, so-and-so's daughter jumped in the river and killed herself because she was being, you know, tweet deluged by a bunch of kids at school who were just got out of control with technology.
Right.
It's exactly right. It's like, but none of the people who use those tools for good or ill have the slightest clue how they work or how much work went into making them. And of course, the people who created these things and invented them had no idea this was down the road. But as you said, you know, we've gotten lazy and we can only think about what can I use this for to fulfill or satisfy this bizarre urge I have that, you know, the Holy Grail really is out there and somebody's or King Arthur was real and we can find out where he was buried or something like that.
Right.
Related to this was something we discussed on the phone briefly was half jokingly we were talking about, you know, the flat earthers and I quipped about how, gee, you know, poor Bob Sungenis, after years and years of, you know, publishing books and, you know, mimeographs and stuff like that. All of a sudden, like, you know, in the age of the internet and Facebook, he's completely upstaged now by, what, a couple of basketball players who decided to go live about believing the flat earth. But I think in reality, these people have always been there. It's just that the interconnectivity of the internet and smartphones and stuff has given them an opening to come out. Whereas before they were kind of confined to their little newsletters and, you know, the little monthly or yearly meetings and stuff where they'd kind of all gather.
Right.
Usually at great expense. Like, for example, I'm looking up at this old the website. It's not even a website anymore. It's gone. 20 years ago, I wrote about this kind of subculture of electrical engineers and other people who think Einstein was wrong. And they devoted a great deal of energy, personal energy, intellectual energy, to explaining why relativity was really wrong. And they had a self-published newsletter called Galilean Electrodynamics.
Sounds like Kook Central. Just the very name. Yeah. Right.
The point is, like, now I think even that has become kind of like, you know, passé or disappeared in the deluge of stuff now that is just all over the place, thanks to social media and the internet.
Yeah.
It's
fascinating to me that technology has made all that possible and has created in so many ways. One of the many attempts to get around the theory of evolution was something called the Omphalos hypothesis. Omphalos means belly button. And the idea behind it, which was put forth sometimes jokingly, Dorothy Sayers put forward this idea as a kind of a gag. She's a novelist. But other people put it forward with deadly seriousness. And the idea was simply this, that when you start a novel and you begin reading the first page of that novel, the character that you're meeting for the very first time has no actual past, because the first time you're meeting them is the first time that you meet them on the novel, on the first page of the novel. And so what was put forward was the idea that maybe God created the world the same way, so that Adam and Eve were created full grown, but with belly buttons. And belly buttons, of course, are the mark of an infancy that never actually happened, because they were created full grown. And so trees were created fully formed with tree rings pointing to a past that never actually occurred, and so on and so forth. Now, that I give that one points for creativity. You know? The problem with that whole argument, of course, is that if you take it seriously, it's just as easy to say that the whole universe was created 5 seconds ago. And all of your memories of what I just said about Omphalos and all the rest of it are memories that were implanted into your brain 5 seconds ago by a God who just created everything 5 seconds ago.
Right, the Matrix, yes.
Yeah, and there's no way to argue around that. And at some point, something just goes conk and you go, that's just stupid. I cannot believe in a God or a creation like that, you know. So that's just silly. Now, I mention all that because I had a point, and now I'm drawing a blank. What were you talking about a minute ago before I was saying that?
Well, Dorothy Sayers and the Omphalos theory, and before that. Basically the older style kind of crackpots, you know, who were largely unknown because there was no technology for them to spread their ideas. They had to actually, you know, mimeograph stuff, send it in the mail, do newsletters and
that sort of kind of quaint thing. And that's what you made me think of, because one of the ironies of the internet is that it has allowed a bunch of different subcultures to create a past that never actually existed. As in the Omphalos theory. So you get Wiccans, for example, who have created this entire past full of, you know, the Catholic Church killing 46 million witches. That none of that ever happened, but they've got this whole mythos of persecution that they've cooked up anyway that's based on nothing. Wicca is like, 50, 60 years old. That's it.
Yeah.
And but you get the same thing, for example, with Catholic traditionalists, you know, who have this vision of a church that never existed and are themselves the entire traditionalist movement is almost entirely a creature of the internet. It didn't exist in its present form even 40 years ago because this whole internet subculture that now exists didn't exist because there was no internet.
Right, exactly.
And this is one of the marks of this magical thinking is the creation of realities that don't exist and are not real. And the sciences, weirdly enough, greatly facilitate that. Particularly the communication sciences that have given us the internet, they allow us to create these cognitive bubbles in which small groups of people can tell each other the same fictions over and over again and invent a world that is not there.
Yes.
And I find that fascinating. You know, so now we're getting the latest thing is something called raw water.
Oh, yeah.
which is a fad that I think is going to last about 2 weeks until somebody comes down with a really bad case of dysentery.
Dysentery, yeah.
But, we're all supposed to pay for something called raw water, which is, near as I can tell, is water from the mud puddle out in front of my house. And you drink that, and that is going to have amazing bodybuilding properties that will somehow build up your immune system unless you get cholera. I find that absolutely fascinating, that way in which the sciences have seeded the ground for people to lazily coast back into magical thinking on 100 points. It affects not just our approach to the sciences. It's affecting our approach to politics, international politics, how we're ordering our society together or not ordering it because we don't talk to each other anymore. We talk to our internet bubble.
Yes.
All of that is terrifying and fascinating to me.
Yes. Yeah. Right now it's kind of terrifying. I mean, we have a president who's talking to his own little internet bubble every day.
Exactly right. Exactly right.
The horror of the rest of the country and the world. So.
Right. Right. And that internet bubble, I watched today. This is being recorded on January 11th. You know, and we watched today as the president casually said, sorry for the language, but it's the language that he used, why are we letting people from these shithole countries come to America? By which he meant people with brown skin. Right. Africa, Haiti, the Caribbean, Central American countries and so forth. Why are we letting them in? Why can't we have Norwegians? You know, pure white Aryans, those kind of people.
As if they'd want to come to a country that doesn't provide them anymore with health care of the amenities they've gotten used to.
I know. They live in a country that's supposedly a socialist hellscape. Why would they come here? And meanwhile, all of that remark about shithole countries, of course, is directed to rationalizing the deportation of 200,000 Salvadorans, to kicking out Haitians who came here to get away from the horrors of the quake in Haiti a few years ago. I've got friends from Haiti, and immediately, what the internet allowed people to do was form cognitive bubbles and say, he never said that. This is how this always works. He didn't say it. This is all fake news. And then when it becomes very clear that, yeah, he did say it, then we turn it into, well, it was a brilliant thing to say because those countries are shitholes, and so on. Your microphone is sounding weird. It's starting to be kind of buzzy.
Can you hear me? Can you hear me? Okay.
You sound, no, it's weird. There's something wrong.
Okay. You sound fine to me, so.
Okay. Yeah, that's it's not working. Let's pause this briefly, see if we can get this fixed, and then
okay.
And we're back. Yes, see, this is raw podcasting with, you know, we're real people talking about real things. Well, I thought it'd be fun to move on for a little bit to talk about this Amazon Lord of the Rings or something Tolkien thing. Are they talking about a redo of the Lord of the Rings already?
My understanding was it looks like they've managed to get the rights to everything, like what they call the entire legendarium. And I'm not sure whether their immediate plans to redo Lord of the Rings, but first they might do some of the prior material. Which is to say, they might do some of the
Silmarillion
chapters. They have the Silmarillion if they want to, but I think they're looking more at the unfinished tales, which has sort of and appendixes from the Lord of the Rings to kind of look at, you kind of set up what will eventually become, doing the Hobbit and doing Lord of the Rings. I do know, and you probably saw this, that Ian McKellen has already volunteered to come back as Gandalf. Gotta love the guy, you know. So he said, look, the character's 2,000 years old, so I'm not too old.
Yeah, sure, why not, you know. Well, he was good in the Jackson version, so
yes,
why not.
Yeah.
Wow, you know, well, so we're finally going to get that 72-part, yes, you know, Silmarillion that The Onion promised us.
If there's any hope, I think, because it's Amazon and because, you know, Jeff Bezos is like now the richest man in the world or something like that, they can do this right. I mean, if they bring on some of the folks or people who are like the folks who are doing Game of Thrones, and whether you like it or not, I mean, it's the way they're doing it is, of course, the way they're doing a lot of long form television now is just it's where adults are going, since the movies are now basically turning into, you know, for the ages of 12 to 16 kind of, you know, CGI carnival acts. They're not even films anymore. They're kind of like, you know, templates to, you know, crank out stuff. And
yes,
I think character development is kind of, that kind of thing now is in long form television. So in that sense, I think I'm kind of, maybe excited is too strong a word, because they could bollocks it up. But if you're going to do it, I think this is where you should do it.
I think there's something to be said. Although, you know, on the other hand, of course, Tolkien is, you know, if he's done right, which I got to say, for the most part, The Hobbit excepted, Jackson was able to make Tolkien as cinematic as he should have been.
Yes.
And that made me happy. I there are a few things for me that equal the Charge of the Rohirrim in Return of the King. Still thrills me to the marrow to watch.
Yes.
I love that every time I've ever seen it. So that's my one kind of hesitance about turning it into a TV thing, is TV's too small for that universe. But,
well, unless it's in HD, yes, it won't be TV. It'll be like, you know, HBO TV.
Oh, okay. But it won't be on like an IMAX screen, and that's regrettable. But no.
Well, you could show. I mean, they'll shoot it in the same format as what would end up on an IMAX screen. So I think now everything can just be scaled up and scaled down. You can imagine them like feeding it out on Amazon so people can watch it in their homes and their big screen TVs. But then, you know, getting geeks to come together and say, we're going to have a Lord of the Rings Fest now and watch it on an IMAX screen in New York.
Yeah.
For the next month.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. Yeah. And I would like to see other parts of the Legendarium filmed. I'm not convinced that we need a new Lord of the Rings this soon. I'm one of those people that found myself going, what do you mean another Spider-Man origin story film?
Right.
They just did, and now a Hulk one? They just did the Spider-Man thing twice or three times, you know? And yes. I still am kind of gacked out on the whole superhero thing. I'm really pretty tired of it, you know. But I would like to see, there are parts of the Silmarillion that I'd really love to see put on film. That would be nice.
Yes, I can imagine, definitely.
Yeah, that would be cool. And I'd also like them to just burn The Hobbit and do that all over again by somebody who is not Peter Jackson.
Yes.
and just make it one movie, you know, because it's really just one movie.
Yes. So
if there was anything the world did not need, it was a love triangle between an elf, you know, two elves and a dwarf.
Yes. That was gross.
Nobody wants to see that. Yeah. And, you know, so yeah, I'd like to just burn The Hobbit and start over again with somebody who wasn't just trying to drain a cash cow. But,
yeah. Yeah. There's I think, like, well, for example, it would be fascinating if they would try to tackle the whole Beren and Luthien tale from the Silmarillion.
Yes.
And some of the darker stuff, you know, before that. Because there's lots of very kind of grim, tragic potential in a lot of those tales.
Yes. Well, they're all deeply tragic. You know, that's something that comes through. Tolkien's work all through the Silmarillion is that is, you know, that is a deeply sad book.
Yes.
in many ways, you know, and people, a lot of people have never read the Silmarillion. They're surprised to discover that all of the events of The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings fits onto the last, like, half page.
Yeah.
Of the Silmarillion, right? So it's an immense universe that he's created, and there's a lot to choose from, a lot to play with, you know. So I'd love to
and most of that content he wrote within 10 years of he was actually starting to write it when he was in the trenches. So
yeah,
you know, when he lost, was it 3 out of 4 or 2 out of 3 of his best friends killed?
Yeah,
he's already lost his parents, so you could actually see how his imagination must have been just colored by death.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I always find it ironic when people kind of compare, well, Lord of the Rings was like, you know, not too many characters died. It was a little too happy. And I was like, yeah, but you know, he already kind of killed off everybody and everything he'd written up to that point. I'll cut him some slack.
I would like to see, I would really like to see somebody attempt to do his creation myth. And I say that with great fear and trembling, because I'm not entirely convinced a creation myth can be filmed and it done justice. I think Darren Aronofsky gave it a real try in Noah. Did you ever see Noah?
I did not. That's the one with Russell Crowe?
Right.
Yeah. No, I did not see that. No.
Okay. It's worth seeing. It really is. It is the most intensely a Jewish take on Noah you will ever see. It is totally informed by the Jewish tradition, and Aronofsky takes that tradition very seriously in the film. And one of the things that he attempts to do is Noah is hands down to his children at one point the creation narrative from the beginning of Genesis, which, you know, he received also, and is handing this tradition on. And what Aronofsky tries to do is square that with what we know about the creation of the world from the sciences.
Oh, interesting.
And so it's a very, it's an intensely Jewish film, but it's also taking seriously the, you know, what we know of the world from the sciences. And he does, I think, as good a job as anybody could be expected to do in rendering mythic language into this visual form that is also taking the sciences seriously. So it's worth seeing. I think it's a very fascinating film.
Cool. Okay.
Yeah. I highly recommend it. Some people hated it for some reason. I don't understand why. Anyway, worth seeing.
Cool.
Yeah. Well, let's see. I think we're running out of time. You got any new stuff you wanna talk about that you've been up to?
What am I doing? Well, like you, I'm working on a novel. Hmm. And speaking of technology, exploring new ways to kind of critique yourself and edit yourself as you go along. So I've been working on this thing for 8 years and circulated it. I workshopped it at the Boston Creative Writers Center, Grub Street, handed it off to a couple of editors and paid them to, you know, give me detailed notes, blah, 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 blah. And now what I'm doing is because, you know, we all ultimately want to feel that book in our hands, whether it's a hardcover or a paperback. I'm exploiting the Harvard Bookstore has this kind of print-on-demand technology, which they basically created so that academics could, instead of having to scroll through pages and pages of Google Docs, just ship them stuff directly and say, hey, print this in the form of a trade paperback because I need to read it when I'm, you know, during study break or whatever. So this machine will literally do one-offs. So you send them a PDF and they'll do it, and they have certain specs. So a lot of creative writers now they'll finish their novel and then they'll actually – they literally make just one copy because they want to have it and sit down and read it like it's a book. Because I think I think there is some benefit to doing that as just another way to put your brain in kind of critique mode, mm-hmm. even though it's your own work and you may be still close to it. But I think also reading it that way as opposed to just on the computer screen where, you know, where your eyeballs are starting to fall out of your head after, you know, so many hours. This is just another step in the kind of, you know, editing writing process, and it's not that expensive really. They just charge you for the copies of they make.
Okay.
And so I'm gonna, that's my next step with my novel, which I feel like it's kind of ready to send out, but okay. I want to do this just for myself. So
cool.
But I highly recommend it when you get to that point in your own novel.
Okay. I gotta tell you, novel writing, in the words of Malibu Barbie, is hard. it requires an entirely different set of muscles from yes. what I'm used to using, and because, you know, when you're writing, well, an atheist would argue with this, of course, but when you're writing theology, you're not making stuff up. You're, especially as a Catholic, you're relying on a tradition. All you're doing really is reporting in a certain way.
Right.
And so you don't have to be inventive. You just have to be clear. But with fiction writing, you're making everything up. These people yes. don't exist, right? None of this ever happened. And that's, man, that's hard for me. So it's been a real challenge working on this, but fun.
That's good.
Yeah. Cool. Well, listen, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today. If people want to find your work, where can they go and get it?
You can go to Forbes.com and just put in my name, but I have my own website, which is my last name, media.com. So farrellmedia.com, and I have all my links to my stuff there. But, I mean, you can also find me on Facebook, on Twitter, John W. Farrell. Twitter might actually be the easiest. So I'm kind of all over the place on social media.
All right.
I'm one of the demons inside the iPhone now.
Okay. That's good to know. You know, hopefully your iPhone won't catch fire if you, are looking at John Farrell's stuff. You know, you never know. I'm not going to make any disclaimers on that. It's important to know. But you've been listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we'll be back again soon enough talking about more interesting things about life, the universe, and everything from a Catholic perspective. Until then, have a good week. Bye-bye.